Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is one of the nation's favourite podcasters, presenters and best-selling authors many times over, with her most recent novel, Walking on Sunshine, being the latest to hit the Sunday Times bestsellers list. Born and raised in Essex to an Italian father and Argentine mother, she joined the prestigious Sylvia Young Theatre School as a teenager. And it was there, age 13, she met her future husband and co-author, Tom Fletcher. The pair wouldn't make things official, though, until they turned 18, and he serenaded her with a little song he'd written just for her called All About You. You might have heard it. It went straight to number one in the UK just a few years later when Tom released it with his band, McFly, for Comic Relief. Whilst all this craziness was happening, our guest started very slowly to dip her toes into the world of writing, picking up experience wherever she could, with assignments and columns for Heat magazine and Hello, as well as writing a proudly unpublished manuscript for a book she called Dating McFly is for Dummies. Everything changed in 2013, however, with the arrival of her first novel, the beautifully readable romance Billy and Me, which immediately introduced her as an author to watch. And the years that follow, well, she became one of the most prolific writers in the country, averaging a book a year, sometimes two, including her autobiographic Happy Mum, Happy Baby, My Adventures in Motherhood, and the Eve of Man series, which she co-writes with her husband, Tom. But that, of course, is only half the picture, because also in 2013, her world changed in a completely different way with the arrival of her son Buzz, later welcoming second son Buddy in 2016 and third Max in 2018. Motherhood well and truly took over, and she was soon presenting her very own podcast, Happy Mum, Happy Baby, a show that's become a global mega hit with downloads in the millions and guests including everyone from Jennifer Garner to Her Royal Highness, the Princess of Wales. I'm so excited to be joined by her live on stage at Carfest South this year, with the rarity of having a lovely live audience along too to watch. So let's dive in as we cross now to the author's stage and welcome the brilliant Giovanna Fletcher. Afternoon. Hi, it's Giovanna. You go on the psychiatrist's
this
couch.
This is my second chaise longue today, and I'm not very graceful on them. And it's a leather one. Nice.
That's nice. In this heat, you'll squeak, G.
know. But how does anyone know how to sit on a chaise longue? Because this just feels wrong.
Yeah, no, I think you're doing this, it just about
this.
Right.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
G, thank you so much for doing this today. This marks the year in which you've published your 12th book.
I know. How bonkers is that?
The Dirty Dozen.
Aww, I should have thought about that and called it a Dirty Dozen.
Yeah, you should.
It's crazy, isn't it? I can remember having my first book out and kind of going, only when I get to three will I call myself a proper author. Will it be official? And that just feels like yesterday. So to now have 12 just feels completely bizarre.
I mean, that is a back catalogue. That qualifies you as a very established author with lots and lots of number ones in front of your name every time people write about your work as an author.
Yeah.
But actually, the first book you ever wrote remains unpublished. And I thought, for a bookworm or any aspiring authors, that's really worth knowing, actually.
Yeah. So it was called Data McFly Is for Dummies.
Says the woman that married the singer.
Because, so basically, it kind of, I'm creative, so it was always just, where my mind sort of went. And I can remember us talking about funny stories that happen with girlfriends of people that are in bands. And I was talking to the McFly manager at the time about something, and he was like, gosh, you should write this down, you should write a book. And, it wasn't even the fact, I think it was just the writing that was important. I don't think the subject matter actually mattered that much. And for me, it was all about not looking outside to what's going on with other people and shaming. It was about kind of going, so what have I done wrong actually in this situation? What can I learn from? So it was a really silly step-by-step guide on how to date a guy in a band, like not on how to get one, but what's the etiquette when you get on a tour bus and there's loads of sandwiches?
Right, okay.
Silly,
so it's not about landing a rock star.
No.
It's keeping one.
Well, just not getting kicked off the tour bus because you've nicked someone's favourite sandwich after they've just played Wembley. Silly things like that. But I was just writing, I think, for me. So I was acting at the time, wasn't working. It was just something to get my creative juices flowing. But at that point, I spoke to someone at Heat magazine who knew I was writing but didn't know what. And they just asked if I wanted to go in and do a little bit of work experience there. I started doing their book reviews, their music reviews, and just ended up loving it a little bit more, and found myself meeting a book agent, literary agent, who'd read my blog and was like, have you ever thought about writing yourself? And I was like, well, I have, but that's something that people who go to Oxford do. It's not someone who went to drama school and pretended to be a penguin goes on to do, but I kind of got out of my head eventually and just started to apply myself and just fell in love with it. And also I went out and had lunch with an author friend of mine, Dorothy Coombson, and she just said that we were just randomly talking about what gets you start, like what makes you start writing, what is the point where you talk about writing, where's the line where between you talking about it and you actually doing it? And we were just, she was saying how when it comes to writing, you've just got to get on with it, because otherwise you can think that you might love to write a book, that it's, that's your dream to write a book one day. You might sit down and within the first day absolutely hate it and realise that it's not for you. So the best thing you can do if you ever think about writing a book is to sit down and actually start the process.
And do it, yeah.
Yeah.
And we'll get into the processes of how you create your work, because there's lots of different ways in which you work. But I think a really important thing is that, straight off the bat, we've established that you did this for nothing because you were determined to learn. You didn't get paid by Heat magazine in the first instance. You did work experience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think that's something that a lot of aspiring authors should take on board, because, like you said, you've got to kind of not try before you buy, because it's not quite that, but you've got to get your hands dirty.
Absolutely. And then even when you have got something that can be sent out, the amount of no's that you get, are unbelievable.
How many no's did you get?
I think we sent out to 12, so I got 11 no's and one, and then Penguin had a little gamble, and we're like, yeah, okay, we'll give you a two-book deal. But I mean, it just takes one person to see something, to enjoy it, and because also it is subjective,
it is.
Kind of, you're going to end up writing something that connects with that one person on that day that she, picks it up.
Absolutely, and it is about turning one head
in
that first instance.
And I think it's the whole J.K. Rowling thing as well. I think she was turned down about 60 times.
Yeah.
And like, that's Harry Potter.
Exactly. Mic drop.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You only got 11.
I mean, I don't like to sound
I don't
better,
know that you've struggled enough, frankly.
No, but there is a whole lot of work that goes into becoming that, that you do have to not be getting paid for it. You do have to, you know, I know so many authors who started off writing on their commute.
Yes.
You know, that's how they spend the whole time. So they'd get 500 words a day, which isn't a lot when you're writing a 90,000, 100,000 word book. But, you know, it's just little and often. Just keep going, keep chipping.
Yeah. Now, when G agreed to come and do this chat today, she's already been twice on a podcast that I do called White Wine Question Time, and I thought it would be fun to make it a hat trick today. Now, normally on White Wine Question Time, we ask three questions, but the third question I'm leaving to you guys, and I want lots of questions, and we would normally punctuate each question with a glass of wine, if only I'd had enough booze to bring for you all. So, if you are drinking, I salute you, and if you're not, I'm sorry. But are we ready to dive in and pop our cork on the first question?
Yes.
Good. So we're at Carfest. This is the author's stage, and an author works in chapters. And I wanted to know what have been the most significant chapters in your own life that have brought you to where you are today, an author, 12 books in your back catalogue, and what you'd call those chapters, what their headings would be.
Gosh. I think even my childhood would be a whole load of different chapters. So up until the age of 9, I was bullied. So not a very happy child kind of school life-wise, but I loved my brother and my sister. Like, everything was just us outside playing. And I loved that. And I do think, although the bullying was awful and we did move as a result of it, I would not
it
be the person.
It was that bad, G, that you had to move house.
Yeah, it was pretty awful.
You're being quite kind of okay about this, and that's huge. So what was happening?
Lots of name-calling, pushing, being, like, pushed into, like, rose bushes and stuff. I think a low point for me was having to go to the school nurse that she could pick rose thorns out my butt. That was pretty bad. But just not very nice behaviour, which as a 9-year-old, all I wanted was for people to like me. And I think as an adult, actually, which is a great thing about books, you know, you see something and it kind of layers what comes after. I think for a long time I had a huge desire and need for people to like me and to approve of who I am, I guess. And I think part of growing up and part of having kids certainly is realizing that you're never going to please everyone. And that's fine. It's okay if people don't like you. But yeah, but that's definitely massively shaped me.
So this was when you were 9, so you weren't even at secondary school?
No, so we moved and then I went to a normal secondary school where we lived, and that was all lovely. And then at 13, I moved school. I saw Sylvia Young on Live and Kicking one day, and I had no idea that there were real life drama schools, like real life theatre schools that you could go to that were a bit like, there was a TV show at the time called The Biz. And I thought, wow, you can go to school every day and it'd be like The Biz. I want to go there. So without my parents knowing, I phoned up the school, ordered a prospectus, applied for the scholarship, and then the letter came through to say, this is your audition date. So I was like, Mum, Dad, we're going to London. And I'd been part of like the local amateur dramatics group, but part of the result of me being bullied is that I spent a lot of time on my own, walking around the school field, acting out like little stories, singing little songs. So when I did go to another school where I could actually let those things out, it was a whole other world. There's a whole other side to me. And that led me to apply to Sylvia's. But I'd never gone for like proper auditions or anything like that.
And just so you know, Sylvia Young Stage School is probably the most prolific in the country. There are only a handful of places and only the very best make it through. And Sylvia's, I mean, one class, I'll give you an example. One class had in Emma Bunton, three members of All Saints, Keely Hawes and Danny Bear and Denise Van Outen. That was one year. And G, who's never done a professional audition, bags herself a slot at Sylvia's. I mean, this is a huge achievement.
When I went, there were 140 children in the whole school, and that ranged from years, well, they had a couple of the juniors there, so that would be year 3 and 4 up to year 11. So our class was like less than 20 people.
Did you find when you got there that you
did you feel like you'd found your people in this, and that your days of wandering around a field being kind of lonely and misunderstood were done?
Absolutely.
Good.
Because you had so many people who were focused on a joint love.
Yeah.
You know, it was just wonderful in that way. And I think it's very easy to think, like, stage school kids, stage school brats. Sylvia grounded us. Like, she would properly keep us in our places. You know, there'd be a little sign outside the agency, because there was an acting agency attached to the school, and you'd be highlighted if you needed to go in and speak to them, which either meant that you got an audition or you had bagged yourself a job. And Sylvia was so strict about how people reacted even to that sign, because if you went above your station, if you showed off, if you flaunted it, she would really be quite annoyed. You know, even the air kisses around, you know, oh, darling, darling, none of that.
None
we weren't
of it.
Allowed to wear makeup. We had to be kids. And I think whether people went to Sylvia's and came out and went into acting or not, I think it gave people a clear idea of what it is to be a professional human. Not we were kids as well, because we were kept innocent in many ways, but it gave us another layer to our being, I think, and a perspective that is maybe different to other kids.
But I think as well, what you are is a bunch of kids who will probably in any other school environment stand out and be picked on,
yeah,
as you've discovered, and yet you were amongst your own when you all came together.
Yeah.
And I've been to Sylvia's a few times to watch some of the shows. I get drunk on the atmosphere in there. It's so exciting because it feels like the halls are filled with possibilities, and so many great talents have come out of there and gone on to really flourish.
Well, and Amy Winehouse, so, you know, one of my highlights during my year 9, so she was in year 11, she would, on Thursdays, she would not do tap lessons. So she'd just, I don't think Sylvia knew about this, but she would just skip tap and just permanently be in with Peter Roberts singing.
Wow.
And during every class, it'd be like, so Amy, do you want to take this one? And even then, she didn't have the voice that she was known for, but she had a voice that you just wanted to listen to. And I think that was a great thing about the school, is that you just feel proud of everyone. You want to see everyone shine. Mm. You don't have anyone trying to diminish that or to belittle it. You just are amazed at what people can do.
And that it's celebrated, and that people know what to do with it, right? Because I think in a normal school situation, how do you propel an Amy Winehouse to Amy Winehouseness?
Yeah.
I don't know that, you know, you almost need to be in a specialist environment. What did you take from your time at Sylvia's? How did it help you to grow and build and flourish?
I took a husband.
You did. the rock star that she didn't get kicked off the tour bus for.
Tom was there. So Tom, me and Tom met at my first day at Sylvia's. So I was 13, and we sat next to each other in assembly. And he turned around to me and said, what's your name? I said, Giovanna, but you can call me G. And he said, my name's Tom, but you can call me T. Fast forward almost 20 years, and here we are.
G and T.
More than 20 years. We met in 98. We met in 98, so 24 years ago.
G, that's amazing.
Yeah. But I think it taught me so much. I don't know who I would be if I hadn't have had that 3 years at Sylvia's.
Is that all it was, 3 years?
3 years, but I promised my previous head teacher that I would go back and do my A-levels there. So that's exactly what I did.
You did. What was it like going back to a regular school after, you know, listening to Amy Winehouse sing every Thursday and gazing at your future husband?
Well, thankfully, though, I was going into sixth form, there's another level of independence. So I was used to getting on a train from 13 into London on my own, doing that whole thing, just feeling like an adult. So I think going back into a sixth form, there is a different level of adulthood.
Yeah.
So that is quite nice. You know, you can just leave school if you want. You can just walk out the doors. But certainly very different. And also, I discovered a social life far too young at 16, but there was suddenly this other world that was opened up to me that we didn't have at Sylvia's,
right?
Which was pretty fascinating.
Can I ask, the people that pushed you in the rose bushes, were they still there when you went back for sixth?
Different school by that point. Yeah,
secondary school.
But weirdly, I went to see a show. I went to see Les Mis because a friend's sister was in it, but it must have been about 5 years after I'd left, thinking that was completely behind me. And one of my bullies, her little sister, was in the show and looked exactly like her sister did. And I sat in that audience and I could just feel the anxiety. Yeah, yeah. So I find that fascinating how things happen to us in life and we feel, and we move past it and we feel like we're over it, and then all of a sudden, bam, you're back there.
Yeah, and you're reduced to feeling in exactly how you did as a 9-year-old again.
Yeah, yeah.
But those lessons in life, they have value. They're difficult, they're horrible, but without them, would you be you?
Exactly, and that's everything, isn't it? It's all these little things that we collect along the way, all these different tools, yeah. All these different learnings, you know, whether they're mistakes that you have to learn from or whether they're successes that you still have to learn from, because it doesn't mean that they're going to happen again. All these different connections that you make. I think we live in an industry where you make fiercely strong connections with people, fiercely, yeah. While you're working together.
It intense,
is. You're
yeah.
So intense and you absolutely adore each other. And that never goes, but you do then just go on your separate ways and you get a new job and another fierce connection. But then when you see each other, you're like, oh, yeah. We shared a really special time.
And that's okay.
And that's okay. And I think that's what life should be in many ways. We should be making strong connections all the time and not feel like we constantly have to
choose
hold
one over
on
the
to
other.
Them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. You did go back to Sylvia's one more time, though. Well, it wasn't quite Sylvia's then. I love this story. So Tom took you back to what was the old site
yes.
of Sylvia's school as you had when you'd attended there. It's somewhere else now, but what was the occasion?
Well, I was told, so at the time I knew the boys were making a McFly documentary, like a McFly on the wall, and I was told each band member was going back to their old school to film like a little bit about their time there. And seeing as me and Tom had gone to school together, could I go with Tom to record and reminisce together? Like, great, amazing. I turned up. So I opened this door and I just saw flowers and candles. And I just literally shut the door so quickly. I was like, no, no. And I text Tom and I was like, am I meant to just walk in? Because I thought, oh my God, what is... What? You just know, you know, when you know what's coming. Like, we've been together 9 years by this point.
But also, this building was disused at this point, right?
Yes, it
so,
was like
so this
proper...
is an empty old school with
which
a
used to be a church.
Yes.
So proper atmospheric, like proper dusty, like certain walls were knocked down, but you could still see the imprint of where Sylvia's was. So I went in and I could literally hear like one of our songs playing. And I walked in. The first thing Tom said was, there are no cameras. I said, okay. So I went into this spot, candles everywhere, roses everywhere, petals everywhere, and just this one polished spot on this really dusty floor, which is where me and Tom first met. And he got down on one knee and proposed.
I love this story. I've got goosebumps.
But the weird thing that night, so you know when you just like, especially nowadays, enjoy the moment, be in the moment. Don't, you know, get your phone out straight away and start telling people, just be in the moment. So he loved that. It was an amazing night, amazing moment. And aww. Then he booked to go to the Ivy, which is where we go every year for our anniversary. We just get, we're people that like what we like and we're like, that's where we go.
We know what we like and we like what we do.
Exactly, that. So we were in the taxi, went to the Ivy and we got there. And usually like Papa out there, they don't care about us. We're people that can just walk in. But this lady came out of the restaurant and she was super drunk. And I've never had someone even do this to me before, but she literally, she was like talking to Tom, talking to me, ran her hand down my shoulder and held onto my hand and was like, oh, is that new? And the Pat was like, excuse me? So we spent the first like 15 minutes in the Ivy frantically texting our friends and our parents and everything, just kind of going, so this happened before everyone else found out because of some drunken, yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
But so magical. And I can remember that night not being able to sleep, like Googling different things, honeymoon destinations. Like just
skip
things.
The wedding straight to the holiday, yeah?
Well, if we get married at this time of year, then it's really hot there.
That's brilliant. I mean, what a beautiful full stop on your amazing time in that building as well.
Yeah,
I love
exactly,
that.
Exactly.
So that's two chapters of your life. So what would you call the first one? The 9-year-old you that was having a hard time. What would you call that chapter?
It's hard, isn't it? Because overall, it's quite a sad time, but really, it's also really positive because...
It's what doesn't kill you will make you stronger.
Yeah, and also if I didn't have that, then I wouldn't have had that time off in my imagination, you know. Maybe I'd call it imaginary friends.
And the Sylvia years. Aww. What would they fall under?
Probably finding my happy place.
Yeah.
I'd go with that.
It is, yeah. It became the roof under which everything amazing happened.
Well, literally, like, my life would not be my life had I not gone to Sylvia's. Yeah. You know, whether that's those 3 years and how they really impacted me, whether that's my relationship with Tom and my other friends that, you know, I made during that time. You know, I've got an amazing friend, Lauren, who at the end of year 10, she wasn't going to be able to come anymore because financially she came from Wales. You know, it was a lot to come up and board every week. So my family just said, well, she can come and stay with us for a year. So having my best friend in my room for a year was incredible, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, talk about finding your people. She was very much found in my home. And I think Sylvia's impacted me in many, many ways. I'll never know who I would have been had I not gone
there.
That's
brilliant, G. That's brilliant. Goes to show as well, doesn't it, the power of getting the right education for you as a child. Might not be right for everyone else, but that's remarkable, which has taken us to where you are now and which takes me very nicely to my next question.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I wanted to talk about the brass tacks of how you write, because not only have you written your own number one bestsellers, but you've also written a trilogy with your husband in a house with three small children. And how do you carve up those two very different ways of working? And I'm sure that anybody here that loves books and read books but also aspires to write them, love to know how you start a book and what that process is.
Well, we've still got to write the third of the trilogy, and fans of the trilogy will be glaring at me right now. But it is lit. So when you're writing as a pair, what the trickiest bit is scheduling. Because I might go, so in July I was like, great, I am ready, I'm going to go back and read the other two, we can get on this. And then two other writing projects are coming for Tom, so we just have to wait a little bit for that. But I mean, it's a conversation, guys, that we keep having, don't worry.
Because the thing is, you write, so the way the books are written is you take a chunk each, right? You take a different narrative each. So you take, you explain this.
Yeah, so Eve of Man, it follows Eve and Bram and Michael in the second book. And so we use our voices, I guess. Rather than us both trying to work out who are these characters that we can both write collectively as one, why don't we make the most of us having two separate voices? Me find Eve, you find Bram, and see how that works. And it does work really, really well. But we need, basically, when you start writing a book for us, right? Because I write very differently when it's both of us and when I write on my own. But together, we spend about a month planning and literally firing what's going on. We'll have a really nice long document that's even got like dialogue in it, because we'll try and pack it out as much as we can with info so that we both know exactly.
And do you put a story arc in? Do you understand where it's going to end? Or
yes,
you're doing good.
I really want to be one of those authors that has the post-it notes, and each time I get the big board and I get the post-it notes, and then I don't do anything with them. But I really would like to be that person. But yeah, so with Tom though, we do plan a lot more. The reason I didn't used to do that, so the way I used to write with my solo work is that I would know what my concept is, I'd know who my main character is, and I'd know roughly the first third and then where I wanted it to end. So I'd get to the end of the first third and just let the characters fly in a really great way. I used to absolutely love it. And the reason I did that is because growing up, I used to play with my Barbies and my dolls, and I used to plan everything while I was setting up. Like, I'd act out scenes in my head while I was putting the Barbies things out and all of this. And then when it was all set up, I'd be like, well, I've done it now. Like, where's the joy in doing it? Because
you like all the prep and the planning, yeah.
Well, yeah,
that's
I've ruined
the author
it
in you.
So my problem with planning, I thought, was that I would have the same experience, that I'd do all this planning, and then I'd get to write it, and I'd be like, oh, well, I'm bored of myself now. Whereas actually, what I have discovered that with planning, writing's layers still. So you're still forever finding stuff. Mm. You're still, you know, something you wrote a couple of months ago might make you springboard into something else now, and that's really exciting. So yeah,
but the planning is the spine from which everything else hangs, I suppose. It's, you know, that's the bones of the piece, and then you write the meat on the bones.
Exactly. Like, so now I don't do the whole third thing. Now I realise that it is my job, and I should be an adult and should actually plan stuff, and that it doesn't dull my imagination by doing so. I think I was just scared to plan. It was never that I was lazy about it. It was just that I really relish and enjoy discovering it as it goes, especially because a lot of my work is first person. Yeah. So I wonder, actually, if I wasn't writing in that way, if I had a bit more of an outside look on it as I was creating, whether I would have let myself off on that a little bit more. But because of being in it, you almost don't want to experience it too much in the planning, because otherwise you might lose bits. But now I realise if I feel like I'm experiencing it, write that down, because that is key info that I can then write when I am putting meat on the bones.
When you've got all these narratives and characters working around in your head, does it feel sometimes like you're walking around with sort of multiple personality disorder? Because you're living and breathing these characters. You take them to bed with you. They wake you up in the night. You know, you have to live it to a degree, don't you?
It's when they are in a position of having to figure things out, the difficult part of life, that it really sits on me. And I used to go to Tom and try and, you know, work through things with him, but he's forever trying to kill my characters off.
Really?
Yeah. He's like, just kill her off, and then the other two guys can go off, and then they can send postcards back to her unborn child. And I'm like, no, this is silly. So I've learned not to go to him for any kind of book chat. But I also, what I find really useful for me when I do get stuck in that way is to just get writing. Just write. Even if you end up deleting it, write, because it will all make sense. It will all come together.
Well, sometimes it clears the blockage, doesn't it?
Yeah, just to
write your way through it.
And for me, the characters they become my mates. Like writing Dream a Little Dream, every week the main character used to go and do pub quizzes on a Wednesday with her best mates. And I had just had Buzz by that point, and I was missing my friends. I'd had this baby, and then I was away from the baby because I was having to go back to the day job. So always being pulled, I felt like I was like missing. I can remember one day my dad and my brother had Buzz, and they'd taken him to the park. I hadn't put Buzz in the swings by this point. They put him in the swings. I can remember another picture popping through of Buzz in a supermarket trolley. I'd never done that. just tiny little things. I'm like, I really wish it was me doing that. Yeah, so I found myself writing these friends, writing these characters that I needed. And I feel like that's what I do every single book, whether it's a lesson that I need to learn, a discovery. I write the things that actually I need at that time. And sometimes I don't realise that until I've finished it and I just feel healed in some way or, you know, moved. It's an amazing experience. Frustrating.
I bet.
So frustrating. And I do feel like I lose myself a little bit and I don't realise that I've lost myself until I press send on that final manuscript.
Oh, that must feel good.
I feel like I'm so light. I'm like 6 stone. I'm light. I barely weigh anything and I can dance and I feel so free.
Giddy.
Yes. And I don't realise how heavy it's weighed on me and what how it's impacted the family because of my mood swings, because of me trying to get this work in until it's off. And I'm just like, oh, mummy's home, guys. I'm back.
Look at me. Before we move on to the Q&A with the audience, I did have somebody write into me on Instagram, a man called Pete, who wanted to ask you, how do you concentrate on writing when you have, say, a noisy neighbour or a neighbour who constantly rings your doorbell asking for things like apple pie recipes?
This is my old neighbour.
Yes, it is. This is your neighbour of 12 years, yes. Pete Ratcliffe.
Oh, I love Pete. I love this. He would. So just don't ask the door to Pete. It's my main bit of advice. We basically, so our old house was built. This is such a tangent, but our old house was built on the house in front's garden. And so we got the French lady who lived there, we got her apple tree. So she'd forever be asking me what I was making with the apples. And Pete one day told her that I made an amazing apple soup. Which I then had to start making. It's basically potato with a bit of apple in it. But then, yeah, my famous apple soup came because he put me in it. Yeah. But I do think that when it comes to work like that, so many of us have got so much better at working from home, which is hard because, you know, there's always someone going to knock on the doorbell, whether it's Pete or the postman or whatever. And, you know, I think we're better now at pushing ourselves back into the zone or blocking out. Sometimes when Tom comes in and offers me a cup of coffee, I'm just like, this is lovely, but I'm mid-sentence. It's gone.
Exactly. I mean, well-intended, but annoying.
Yeah, just make the cup of coffee and leave it there. The answer will always be yes.
We've been doing this since we were 13. Come on, keep up. Okay, time for my third and final question for you. In case any of you are feeling a little bit nervous about putting your hand up to ask questions, I want to ask G to talk us through a moment in her career, this is non-writing related, to show you how vulnerable she can be at times and yet still dig deep. And this is something that came to me via Sir Kenneth Branagh, okay? And this features not Giovanna Fletcher, but Giovanna Falcone, as he calls you, who he describes as having a night on stage with him and Tom Hiddleston where you were called on as an understudy. You weren't even given enough notice to get dressed properly. And I'm going to let you pick the story up from here. But frankly, my friend, you had a moment to shine and everything was stacked against you.
So I was in a show called Ivanov at the Wyndham. So it was a Donmar season, like a huge West End season. I wasn't long out of drama school. Kenneth Branagh was the lead, Tom Hiddleston was in it, Andrea Riseborough. So I was understudying.
Wait, she's
Andrea.
Really casual about that. Did you just hear those names, yeah? She's just out of drama school.
I've got to say, I love it at the moment because my kids are really into Marvel. So when they see Loki, I'm like, look at this picture of me and Loki right here. Be good, or he's coming. So we were doing this play, and I was understudying the female lead. And we were a long way into the run, actually. I'd had my understudy run, thankfully, a few weeks before. I'd been on stage that night. I'd done the first chunk of my part. And I was back in my dressing room.
So just in case people don't know, an understudy will probably have a smaller role within the play, but also be prepped to go at any given time to step in to those major leading lady shoes. And this is what happened.
So I was in my dressing room doing my Sudoku. And there was a knock at the door, and it was Howard, the company manager, and he's like, Giovanna, where's your Sasha costume? And I was like, it's right there. He's like, great. All of a sudden, the door completely opens, the whole of the wardrobe department file in. They're like, we're getting you ready because Andrea doesn't feel very well, so we're just, she'll probably be fine, but we're just going to get you ready. 3 minutes until she's due to go back on stage. Then they get a little announcement over there. They get, you know, someone contacts them on the walkie-talkie, says, don't worry, she's fine, she's going to go on, but still keep getting G ready. Great. And literally 10 to 15 seconds before Andrea is due to hit the stage, there's an announcement over the tannoy. Could Miss Falcone please come to the stage immediately? Miss Falcone to the stage immediately. Literally, I ran down to the stage. All the doors were open where everyone in the theatre was like, oh, come on. Got to the side of stage. As the cue light was going green for me to walk on stage, you have Kenneth Branagh and Tom Hiddleston. I'll reenact it. So, Tom's over here, Ken's here. Very heated exchange. Tom Hiddleston has tears in his eyes. Right. I walk in over here. Tom says the first thing he sees is just Andrea, because he's got tears in his eyes. He can't see. And he was like, as the tears started lowering, he sees Andriana, then Giovanna. And he's like, what on earth is going on? Ken says that all he saw is his eyes. He just saw Tom's eyes getting wider and wider and wider. So he had to turn around to see what was going on. And his first line was, Sasha, what are you doing here? But we literally had 10 seconds where we just looked at each other and went, oh, what are we doing? But thankfully, because of that first line, the audience all went, okay,
she's Sasha.
We get it. But it's so funny because Ken was on Rob Brydon's podcast,
which is where I heard this story,
talking about it because I'd just won the castle. And his version of events, though, bear in mind, I had messaged everyone that night, like my version of it. And his version was that my clothes didn't fit, that I just literally stayed over there because someone was still holding my skirt up. I'm like, that didn't happen at all. He was very lovely about it.
He said that you came on and you hadn't had time to dress properly, so the stage manager was pinning with their bare hands your clothes together whilst you stood there quite stiffly because your clothes could have fallen off, but that you didn't drop a beat in terms of dialogue and that you were quite remarkable.
Do you know what? The adrenaline, though, just took me through that night. The next day, I found out at midday that I was going on again. But then the whole week that I was finding out at 25 past seven that I was going to be going on that night because Andrea was poorly but still wanting to push through and get on, but she was being told that she just wasn't very well.
Yeah.
And thankfully, the last Saturday, so our final two shows, Ken just kind of took a stand and was like, we need to know and G needs to know, because she's either going to go on and do her part or she's going on as Sasha, and we all know where we stand. And I went on for the final two shows, which was amazing.
But can I just point out that to this day, Sir Kenneth Branagh has made, I mean, you can, there's not enough fingers on my hands to count the amazing films that he's made, all the productions that he's been in, and he still remembers that moment with you because you make such a phenomenal impression wherever you go, Jay. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's very sweet.
It's very true. Okay, your turn, audience at Carfest. Gentleman with his hand up there, thank you very much.
Hello. The English language, in my mind, is fantastic. It's also rather complex in terms of grammar and punctuation, etc. Yeah. Being an author, you will know, obviously, about the usefulness of proofreaders, etc. One of the phrases that really irritates me is revert back. What grinds your gears?
Great question.
I only found out that you can't say equally as when I was in the sound booth in the recording studio doing the audio of my book, and the producer was like, you don't need both, it's equally. or as. You don't.
It's one or the other.
It's
right.
One you don't need. And I was like, okay. But I could not. My books would be rubbish if it wasn't for the proofreader, if it wasn't for the copy editor. And I can remember the first time I had a book come back to me from the copy editor and being so embarrassed. And she was like, why? It's my job. It's my job to correct those things. If you were perfect, I wouldn't have a job. And I think that can stop a lot of people from trying to write because they think they have to be... There are all these rules set out. There are these things you have to follow. Mm. No, you don't. You have to tell a story. Tell the story and someone else can put it right, like grammatically. And Cressida Cowell, the Children's Laureate, is amazing because she's really campaigned for 15 minutes a week for children to just sit down and be creative, just to free flow when it comes to writing. Don't let that sentence of a structure stop you from getting those things out. So when like my kids come back now and they tell me all about these different types of words they're meant to be using, I'm like, let's Google that. Because I have got no idea. I write from the heart. I want that character to be able to put her words down. I also write in a first person narrative, which also helps. But I don't want the English language to be a barricade to stop me getting those words down. But yeah, no one's books would exist if it wasn't for those people.
What about the stuff though that grinds your gears? Do you find that there's one author that I love, and she uses the word skullduggery, which I think nobody uses that in conversation.
Yeah, but she's probably got this thing,
and it grinds my gears.
I have this thing where I love the word lugubrious,
ooh,
which means sorrow, or like lugubriously means sorrowfully, or you know, sadly, like lugubriously. But it's
nice,
a great word.
Nice word.
I try and get it in every book.
Yeah,
I just love it, and
I'm going to play bingo on that and have a read.
But I know that it probably doesn't need it. I could put in a different word. But sometimes it's just nice to put in a little...
I like it.
I don't like books. I've got to say, actually, I don't like books where I'm a sentence in it and I already need a dictionary. I feel like they are so...
They're throwing shade at you.
They are.
They're airing you, as my son would say.
You are not intelligent enough to read this book.
You don't belong here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Go to a book with smaller words.
And that is my happy place.
That's my happy place. Do I have any more questions? Yes, lady at the front here.
Hello. I love your books. They're absolutely amazing.
Oh.
And this one is starting to read them. But we actually have a different question.
Do you want to ask the question?
Amelia fell in love with you during the castle and the jungle. Can you tell us a little bit about the time?
Yeah. What would you like to know? First of all, it was really, really cold. So we had our kits and we also had thermals. And I was keeping my thermals as pyjamas because I thought I was really clever to have something fresh to put on every
night. Such a mum.
I mean, I just stank all the time. But something fresh to put on before going to bed every night. I was still cold, although I was doing the cooking. 10 days in, I realised that everyone else wore their thermals the whole time because it was so cold.
Wow.
It changed my time there.
What about the food there? Because obviously you didn't have to do quite the severity of some of the eating trials that Australia throws up, but you still
do
had
you
some...
know what I ate?
Yeah, I know. I was going to say, tell us what you ate. I mean, let me point out, you won't find it at a food fan at Carfest. I hope not.
No, so normal food, we had the rice and the beans, which the first night, because obviously you're meant to soak them overnight or as long as possible, and the first night you have half an hour in which to cook your food because you're that hungry. So we had it and they were literally like bullets and we just didn't know how we were going to cope at all.
And let me just point out, by the way, you then have to pass that and that's also not pleasant. And there is a lot of discomfort within camp.
Yes. But thankfully, someone in the Telegraph did say, you're meant to soak them. Like, thank you. It was not nice, the food, is what I could say. So the rice and beans actually were my comfort place. Anything that came in was vile. The first night, actually, so we went in on a Friday. Saturday was kind of our off day, but not off, but just... We knew that in terms of like the business world, we knew that Friday was going to be edited for Sunday night show. So we knew that nothing really on the Saturday was going to be made, like put on TV.
Very smart. You'd worked out that that's when you could...
The only reason we really knew this is because they gave us sausages that night. But for the first night,
sausages.
We were like, sausages. This is gonna be okay. No, we basically ate an entire park. It was awful.
You were fed false hope with the sausage.
Yes, I think the next night probably squirrel came in. But what I found really difficult was anything that we won on the trials, all those nice stars that we got, it was just vile, the food when you actually... Like, the meat stuff was fine, like, because I was cooking it. The meat stuff was okay, but the veg just tasted of the horrible water. And so many meals, I could feel myself gagging and having to kind of say to myself, don't do that. Don't do that, because if one of these cameras see you, you're going to be doing all the eating trials, so do not do that. And then I did have an eating trial, and I just remember going down to it going, I don't know what is going to happen in this next, like, it took me 17 minutes to eat a lamb's testicle because
oh
I worked out.
Oh my God,
because
I think that's not quick. I mean, I could be there for weeks.
But you're not allowed water. So the thing that people do wrong is they just try and eat everything really, really, really quickly. So therefore you gag. Thankfully, Vernon had said to me before going down, just remember, if it's anything like, you know, they have to wash it. They have to boil it. Health and safety, that has to go through a process before it ends up in your mouth. Still tasted of wee. But it's more a mind over matter thing. So it's gristly, it's horrible, it's how it sits in your mouth. So it's kind of like a take your time and chew it. I think I gagged once. I know I only gagged once. And that was on the fisheye because of the pop and the saltiness. And I'd not had salt for like 3 weeks by that point, so it was really quite overwhelmingly salty.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, the only thing I can think to ask is, what the hell did you say yes to doing that show?
It was the best experience ever. And even then, like, I was sat down for a very weird meal with Anton Deck. You know, so they were making me laugh the whole way through. So it was really entertaining. The worst thing that I did was mean massage, where... four of us sat
mean
in a room.
Mean massage.
Honestly, it was a challenge.
Think about the evil people that think this stuff up.
Yes. So it was a challenge. It wasn't a trial. So the difference between challenge and a trial really is that Anna Deck aren't there. So we went into this room, mean massage. Basically, you lie, so you're strapped down on a masseuse table with your face out. And you'd see the ranger's feet coming next to your bed and they'd just chuck things over you. That was the most difficult thing ever. I had Beverly Callard going, Norgy, oh, Norgy. Ruthie was just singing the whole time and then stopped. Jessica was just being like, Gigi. Like, so I just felt like I knew from day one, if I fell apart, so many other people were coming with me. So I think I had my head somewhere else, like even in those situations. And I do think that, you know, I went in there to get away from my motherly responsibility, I guess, in a way.
But you did become the mum of the camp.
But that is what pulls you through. That's what pushes you through, because you're worried about other people. So therefore, sometimes not putting yourself first is the best thing, because it takes you out of where you actually are. Like, I was so freaked out about my ears. One thing, because I had really bad hearing as a child, really bad. Like, I used to hit people, awful. Like, I was a really difficult child, to the point where I was taken to like a board of governors with my mum, and it was really, really bad.
Because you couldn't hear?
Because I couldn't hear, I was so frustrated. And and so my ears are something that I get really panicky about, and I could feel these little worms near my ears, and I get recurring ear infections, that's the only thing. So looking after the others kind of took me away from the maggots that might be in my ears. But the first thing that I did when I got off that table was get to the medic and go, check it.
Get them out.
Yeah. I mean, other people are off getting naked so they could get the maggots out of their ears. I was like, I don't care if there are maggots in my pants. Are the maggots in my ears?
You might want to rethink that. Sadly, on that note, we are going to have to wrap things up. And I know there are so many more questions for G, but you know what? The reason you went on to win the jungle is for those moments, isn't it? It is ultimately it's Britain's biggest popularity contest, and you won because we love you.
Aww.
And thank you so much for your time today, G.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
A huge thanks to Carfest for hosting us and to Giovanna, whose latest book, Walking on Sunshine, is available wherever you get your books. And don't forget, if you want to come down next year to Carfest and see brilliant chats like this, as well as amazing acts live on the music stage and so much more, tickets are available now. Can't recommend it enough. You can find them at carfest.org. That's carfest.org. And if you've loved listening to this episode, then we have plenty more great chat with other great leading ladies. Our back catalogue features episodes with the likes of Ruth Langsford, Lorraine Kelly, Andrea McLean, Ulrika Johnson, Arlene Phillips, Charlene White, Gabby Roslin, Anita Rani and Emma Willis, to name but a few. My thanks to you, as always, for your company, and to Maria Nibbs and the Yahoo Studios team who produced the show with me. Editing is by Eleanor Humphrey and our music is courtesy of Andy Bell, a star of the 90s, noughties and then some. You can check out his solo material as well as his work with Ride and Oasis wherever you get your music. We'll see you next Friday. Thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.